intimate alliance form between the supreme enemy of humans and their last and greatest protector. I explained simply to pass the time. Forerunners marry for many reasons, but the lower rates are said to marry more often for love. This allows strange liaisons. Humans will never understand. Your own customs are much too primitive. Shakus received this with less than perfect grace. He swore under his breath and took off through the jungle. I thought him remarkably obtuse, unwilling as he was to accept his station in life. Reiser was constantly venturing into the jungle alone and brought back more fruits and a few coconuts. He seemed unconcerned about what might happen next. The didact stayed in the chamber that evening while I hiked through the jungle with my humans. Ownership seemed a more seemly relation than brotherhood. We then gathered on the inner beach under a brilliance of stars. My apprehension and numbness had dissipated and were now, too typically I fear, being replaced by boredom. We had served our purpose. We weren't needed anymore, obviously. If we weren't to be killed or arrested, if the didact ignored us, then perhaps we could make our way to the outer shore and find a boat. But Shakus didn't think so. He pointed out that the profile of the crater's central peak had changed. They'll see it from the rim. That will stop any boats from coming here. I hadn't deigned to be so observant. Generally, personal armor kept track of life's little details, leaving forerunners free to engage in elevated thoughts. What's changed? I asked, irritated. It's dark. It still has trees around its base and bare rocks up to the top. I think the machines are crossing over and working there, he said. Anyway, something is moving rocks. Sphinxes are war machines, not excavators. Maybe there are other machines. We don't see them, I pointed out, and I don't hear anything.
Tomorrow, Reiser suggested,
and vanished into the trees, not to return for hours. Shakus and I made our way to the outer shore. The next night, we tried to follow Reiser on one of his excursions. The little human was apparently allowed to roam freely, but a solitary war sphinx dropped swiftly through the trees and planted itself on curved legs, blocking Shakus and me.
What are we, prisoners? I shouted.
It made no answer. Shakus shook his head, grinning.
What's funny?
I asked, as we trudged back the way we had come, followed by the hovering sphinx. Reiser darted past us with a small pile of nuts. Shakus shouted after him, not in anger, but in humor.
Hamanush are free to come and go, he said. He'll boast about it if we get home. Looks like he's our superior here.
His brain is smaller than yours, I said.
And yours is smaller than the didact's, I'll wager.
No,
I said, and was about to explain the ways of mutation from manipular to higher rates and greater forms while we returned to the clearing around the half-buried chamber. But my words were choked off. The didact sat in a posture of quiet thought atop the left wall of the ramp. His dark hooded eyes tracked us for the first time, as if we were worthy of some small attention. He grunted and dropped from the wall with newfound agility.
Manipular,
he said.
Why are these humans here?
Shakus and I stood before the Promethean, locked into awed silence. This was it, I thought. The time of judgment and punishment.
Tell me, why humans?
This is our world,
Shakus said, in a fair imitation of the didact's exalted grammar and tone.
Perhaps we should ask why you are here.
I wanted to clamp my hands around his mouth and turn to reprimand him, but the didact raised one powerful arm.
You,
he said, pointing to me.
How came this to be?
The human is telling the truth, I said.
This is a planet reserved for their occupation. I came here seeking artifacts. These humans showed me to your resting place. They have a ga-
A cryptum is not to be violated,
he interrupted, looking off at the sky.
One of you found a way to open my vessel. Who and how?
His sadness was like a pall over the beach and the jungle. For me, in the presence of such a senior forerunner, it seemed as if the very air filled with his weary gloom. The humans sang songs, I answered. The cryptum opened.
Only one forerunner would ever be so devious,
the didact said, his voice softening.
Or so clever. You were about to say, the humans have a Gaius. Someone infused them with codes in their infancy, or earlier, genetically.
I think that might be so.
How much time has passed?
Perhaps 1,000 years, I said. A very long sleep.
Not sleep,
the didact said.
I entered the cryptum on another world. Someone brought me here. Why?
We're tools of the librarian, Shaka said. We serve her.
The didact examined the human with distaste.
With my sphinxes, someone helped revive me.
I did, I confirmed.
I had hoped to rise in triumph and recognition of my judgment. But instead, I found myself facing young fools and the offspring of ancient enemies. This is worse than disgrace. Only one other reason, one other provocation would make the librarian revive me under these humiliating circumstances.
He raised one arm, then executed a brief wave in the air with his fingers. The pieces of armor floated out of the chamber, and the didact assumed a position of robing, arms extended. The armor section surrounded his limbs, his torso, and finally the top of his head in shimmering pale bands that floated centimeters above his skin. I was surprised by the humbleness of the armor's design. My father's armor was far more ornate, yet he was not the stuff of legend. Such were the sumptuary rules of forerunners. Even a great Promethean must dress below the style of any builder.
There must be a reason my wife is not here to greet me,
the didact said when he was fully clothed. He stretched his arms to the stars. Beams shot from his fingers, and he sketched out several constellations, as if commanding the stars to move. I felt strangely surprised when they did not. The beams dimmed and went out, and he curled his fingers into fists.
You know nothing.
So I've been told, I said.
You are a mere manipular, and a reckless one at that.
He pointed to Riser.
Little human, I know your kind. You are of an ancient form. I asked you be preserved because you are peaceful yet full of cleverness, worthy pets to amuse and by low example to instruct our young, but you.
He swung his finger around to Shakus.
You are too much like the humans who nearly wrecked my fleets and murdered my warriors. My wife has taken liberties. She provokes me.
He stretched out his arms. The armor flashed.
You provoke me.
Shakus's face clouded, but wisely, he said nothing. The didact seemed to rethink any violent action. His arms dropped, and the armor returned to a state of protection.
Manipular, where did you see first light?
He asked. I explained that my venerable builder family had long inhabited systems in and around the Orion Nebular Complex, near the Forerunner Core.
Why are you naked?
Merses surround this island, I said. They won't tolerate complex machines. My Ancilla...
My wife raised Mercies in our garden shallows,
the didact said.
Never liked them much myself. Show me.
Chapter 7. In a foul mood, Shakus lagged behind the didact, Riser, and me as we hiked along the outer shore, following one of the new trails blazed by the Sphinxes, which were indeed acting as excavators, apparently to the surprise of the didact as well. In truth, he seemed more often dismayed than in control of his surroundings, more often confused than enlightened by what we found. He had no explanation for the reshaping of the central peak.
I am lost here,
he said, as we looked over the outer lake of Jamonkin Crater. He studied the wallowing merse. He found a low boulder and sat again in that contemplative posture that also seemed to reveal exhaustion.
No one can tell me why I am not still in timeless peace.
In exile, I said. He glowered.
Yes, exile. Forced to retreat for speaking truth, tactical and strategic wisdom. Useless against the bold assertions of the Master Builder.
He stopped himself.
But those matters are not for the ears of a manipular. Tell me, are the weapons finished? Have they been used?
I told him I knew nothing of weapons.
That means little. As a manipular, you have no need to understand your greater circumstances. Worse, however, you apparently focus on personal gain and treasure, precursor artifacts. No doubt you seek the Organon.
His words stabbed deep, not just because they were true. I am honest to my goals. I seek diversion, I said. Excuses for adventure are means to an end, I quoted. You are what you dare.
The
didact murmured, shaking his great head.
So I told her once, and she's chided me with it ever since.
He looked out over the lake and the clear, cloudless morning sunrise. A breeze sallied from the west into the crater's wide bowl and dappled the blue waters, eliciting circlets of foam from agitated merse.
Ugly, mean brutes,
the didact observed. His rancor cooled.
What ritual allowed you to come here without being attacked?
I explained about humans and their wooden boats, powered by steam, but even then requiring soft, watery songs to cross safely.
Humans making tools. Again. I have been well and cleverly hidden. No other forerunner would seek me here.
Long time, Riser confirmed. He seemed comfortable around the didact, as if from instinct. I saw it clearly. A servant species favored for ages. No wonder Shakus was in a foul mood. His own instincts were likely either blank, long erased, or filled with much darker memories. Your cryptum killed any human who approached, I said. At least any stupid human.
A selection process,
the didact said. But there was a safe way in, partly. Someone made a puzzle that would stick in the human imagination, so humans came time and again and sacrificed themselves, and the survivors erected walls and laid pebbles to show the way. Someone wanted you to be found when the time was right. This seemed to sink the didact into deeper gloom.
Then it is almost over, he said. All we have tried to do as inheritors of the mantle, all that will be violated. And the galaxy will be murdered because they do not understand.
He let out a grating sigh.
Worse, it may already be loose. Join your human friends and sing sad songs, Manipular. There is judgment, and just
doom
is upon us all.
It is what you all deserve, no more, Shaka said, throwing down a shred of palm. The Promethean paid him no attention. Chapter 8. That night, in the dark, the profile of the central peak altered abruptly. Thousands of sparking fires and bluish glows burned around the jutting prominence, like the flitting of lightning insects, until the dawn snuffed them with the sun's first yellow rays. Riser accompanied me to the inner shore, sharing parts of a coconut and the sour green fruit he favored. He also offered a piece of raw meat from some animal he had snared in the darkness, but I, of course, refused. The mantle forbade the eating of the flesh of unfortunates. Shakus was nowhere to be found. What the sun revealed of the former peak was a circle of slender pillars, rising 1,000 meters out of a remnant base of mountain and surrounded by sloping chutes of scoria. I had never seen the like before, and vaguely wondered if here, finally, was a precursor machine fully active, ready to unleash mischief. I was very confused. My curiosity about all manner of things historical had been sparked by the example of the Didact. If he was indeed the Didact, for how could a great warrior and defender of forerunner civilization, how could a true Promethean feel such a depth of defeat and gloom? What passions, what adventures had this warrior servant known in his long life? And what could have possibly forced such strength and accomplishment to cower in meditative exile? I put little store in his condemnation of other forerunners. Truly, the concept of an end to forerunner history had never occurred to me. I found it ludicrous, and yet the idea of warrior servants laying low entire species, now that I had actually met humans, seemed to violate all the precepts of the mantle. Did not the mantle give us dominion to allow us to uplift and educate our lessers? Even humans, so degraded, deserved that much respect. After all, I had learned much about Shakus from observing him, and my opinions of his degraded status were changing. The Didact's guilt alone might account for his deep sense of darkness and failure. I looked from the inner shore at the revealed pillars and wondered what they were meant for. What would rise through or up and around them? Was it something for the use of the Didact? An architectural beacon announcing his return, or the final instrument of his punishment? I understood nothing about forerunner politics. I had always disdained this concern of mature forms. Now, I felt weak in my ignorance. What shattered my youthful naivete most powerfully was the realization that the world of my people, a world of ageless social order and regimentation, of internal peace against external challenge, might not be eternal. That rising through the forms from manipular to builder, or whatever other destiny I fled so blithely, all that might soon not be a choice. This morning, I felt true mortality for the first time, and not just my own. I now understood the deep old symbol for time. The sweeping opposed hands with lightning between, extended fingers triangulating the pinch of most efficient fates from which there is no return. Shakus interrupted my thoughts with a touch on my shoulder. I turned and saw him standing behind me, looking out at the pillars with a look of bitter dread.
"They're coming from the east," he said.
"Across the lake, over the Merse?"
"No. The sky's filling with ships. The librarian no longer protects us."
"Does the Didact know?"
"Why should I care?" Shakus said. "He's a monster."
"He's a great hero," I said.
"You are a fool," Shakus said, and ran back through the trees.
Chapter 9. The ships moved slowly in a great waving gray and black line from east to west, like a ribbon of steel and adamantium slicing the sky. So many. I had never seen so many ships in one place, even on ceremonial days on my family's homeworld. What I could not understand was the reason so many were necessary, if in fact they were here to capture and incarcerate just one old warrior servant. Even a Promethean, it seemed to me, did not merit such a show of force. But everyone around me seemed to think I was a fool, even a simpleton. I kept to the inner beach, lying on the sand, watching the ships arrange themselves in tight whirls, spiraling in toward Jermonkin Crater. At the center of the whirl, a great builder ship, the largest I had ever seen, and a great miner vessel, easily outmatching anything owned by my Swap family, held steady in a dyadic cloud of buffer energies. The air itself began to feel stiff and harsh with the pressure of so many ships hanging in slow suspension. A shadow of a nearer, darker sort crossed my face, and I angled my head to see a war sphinx just a few meters away, rising on its curved legs. "The Didact requests your presence," it announced. "Why?" I asked. "The entire galaxy is coming to a bitter end. I'm just a piece of waste matter not worth flushing." The Sphinx took a step closer, unfolding upper arms tipped with tangles of flexible grapples. Hard light flashed blue along all its joints. "So it's not a request, huh?" I said, and pushed to my feet. "Do I walk, or are you offering me a ride?" "Suck it up, Manipular," the Sphinx intoned. "Your presence will be useful." I felt for the first time that there might be more than just a mechanical intelligence under its pitted skin. "He wants me to witness him being arrested?" I said. "Is that it?" The grapples flashed like the agile fingers of a Pan-Gut master. "These ships are not here to arrest the Didact," the Sphinx informed me. "They are here to demand his help. He will, of course, refuse." I had no response to this. Instead, I followed the Sphinx quietly through the trees to the inner shore. Since the Sphinx seemed to have found a new purpose, telling me what was what, I ventured another question. "What's with the mountain? Why tear it down?" "It is the librarian's doing." "Oh." That told me nothing, of course, but it was intriguing. Something big was happening, that much was obvious. Without my armor, I wasn't fit to meet my superiors, or even other manipulars, for that matter. But the fact that the Didact still knew I existed, and required my presence, was also intriguing. I looked around the inner shore. Then a glint caught my eye, and I looked up toward the base of the mountain, the cloud-piercing pillars, and saw the other war sphinxes flying across the inner lake, climbing rapidly to several hundred meters. I looked around. The inner beach was deserted. "Where is everybody?" I asked. The Sphinx's control cabin hatch pulled aside with a fluid sigh. "You will join the Didact. Get in." I knew enough about the protocol of warriors and their machines to understand that I was not being recruited into a glorious, defiant fight to the finish. And then it dawned on me, the humans might be riding in sphinxes as well. Why were we so important? I tried to crawl up the pitted, ancient surface. The grapples extended around and aft, providing stirrups. I climbed in through the rear hatch and it sealed behind me. The cabin inside was spacious enough for a mature warrior servant, only slightly smaller than the Didact himself, giving me plenty of room, but no comfort, because nothing was shaped to accommodate a much smaller and almost completely naked manipular. There were a bare seat, a variety of antiquated displays, and control tubes designed to hook up with armor. Standing on the seat, I could see through the slanted, forward-looking direct-view ports that gave the Sphinx's features the illusion of a disdainful downward gaze. I felt only a little bump, and then we were away,
wheeling about to join the general migration toward the dismantled mountain and the mysterious pillars. Above the island, the spiral of ships held position and did nothing, perhaps locked in some sort of dispute. Wherever the Didact was, there was likely to be trouble. I could not imagine the power he had once wielded, that he could still, after 1,000 years, provoke legions of forerunners to seek him out and assemble their ships above the island. We crossed the inner lake in minutes, a leisurely pace for craft designed to drop from high orbit, sweep continents, and decimate cities. The only thing these old machines lacked, I thought, was a direct connection to slipspace. But I didn't know that for sure. The Sphinxes circled the lower reaches of the pillars, then passed between and dropped to a central, octagonal platform. There, they settled in a protective ellipse, just as I had first seen them only a few days before. The hatch opened. I emerged and slid off the rear curve. From another Sphinx, Riser poked out, clearly agitated. Not tall enough to see out the ports, I thought. The Florian ran over and stood close, wringing his hands and trembling.
"Something in there with me,"
he muttered, then smirked up at me and wiped his forehead with one hand.
"Not alive. Not happy. Very bad."
The greater, doubled War Sphinx arrived last and settled in the center of the ellipse. As if at its touch, the platform vibrated under my feet, then began to rotate. All around, the pillars and the base of the mountain, and the ships in formation high above, also seemed to turn. The spiral of ships took on a hypnotic, whirlpool fascination. We felt none of this motion, but still, Riser grunted in dismay. The Didact descended from the doubled Sphinx and walked on his trunk-like legs to confront us.
"You're being kidnapped, young Manipular,"
he grumbled as the pillars sped up.
"The humans have to come as well. Apologies to all."
I looked down to avoid getting dizzy, even without the sensation of spinning. "Why apologize now?" I asked. But Didact's expression did not change. He did not react in the least to my insubordination, whelp that I was, agitating against the Prometheans' thousands of years of life and experience. He simply looked outward, drew his brows down in concentration, and asked,
"Where's the other human?"
"Still hiding," Riser said. "Sick."
Shakus chose this moment to poke his upper body out of the hatch of his transport. He looked woozy. His descent down the sloping back of the machine lacked any dignity, and he landed on bent legs, then slumped to one side and vomited.
"Bad sky," Riser said, stoically.
The Promethean regarded this sign of human weakness with the same emotion he had shown to my insubordination.
"In a few hours, all signs of my stay here will be erased. No one will be able to prove I was ever here."
"Can't the ships see us?"
"Not yet, but they obviously know something."
"Why so many?" I asked.
"They've come to ask my help, or arrest me again. I think the former, and I think I know why. But I must not help them. I've stayed here too long already. It's time to leave. And all of you will come with me."
"Where? How?" My answer arrived even as I spoke. The platform was still rising. The circling pillars sprouted bulkheads, beams and stanchions, all the necessary parts. The skeleton of a slipspace voyager was growing around us, almost too rapidly to track, until the pillars were walled in, the sky and the swirling ships vanished, and we were completely enclosed. Shakus stumbled over to stand on my other side. Clearly he might throw up again. A disgusting practice, and to little purpose, I thought. I was flanked by humans, with the Didact before me, his back turned and arms extended, as if commanding the Voyager to rise and grow by the very gesture of his hands, which might have been the case. They might notice
that, I suggested.
From where they are, they see only a solid island and the water of the lake,
the Didact said.
The ship will grow and launch, and then they will know. The librarian designs beyond her station. She has always planned well.
She made this for you? I asked.
For our greater cause,
the Didact said.
We fight for the grace of the mantle.
The Didact turned to face me as our chamber finished, and I saw we were within a large, fully equipped command center. My father himself could not have designed a more advanced ship. I could easily imagine the outer hull, a gray, gleaming, elongated ovoid at least 1,000 meters in length. The power and the expense had to be enormous. But, cleverly enough, rather than hiding a finished ship, the librarian must have left a builder's design seed under the central peak, updating it as new technology was revealed. Forerunner technology still grew in spurts, even after millions of years. She must have traded great favors for such an installation. Displays flashed into action around the command center and showed views in many frequencies and aspects of the outer island, the distant walls of the crater, and above, I saw as I craned my neck back, the assembled searching ships. A single bright star gleamed just outside the circle of vessels at the center of the fleet spiral. That star marked our voyager's calculated point of departure. In early slip space, we did not want to pass through anything as massive as another ship. We lifted from the island. The command center displays revealed our motion. We felt nothing. At this point, the ships must see us, I thought. Such a large vessel must leave a definite trail. I felt that brief sensation of unencumbering, of all history and memory being cut loose and then painstakingly reassembled, as every particle of our ship and our bodies was wrenched from the doubled hand of time and had to find new scalars, new destinies, far, far away.
The Promethean said. We are away. It is done.
The displays tracked our course. We were moving outward along the great spiral arm that held both the Orion complex and Erde Tyrene. Just a few tens of thousands of light years. Hours at most would pass for us. Had I known where we were fleeing and what we would find? Against the greatest and most solemn instructions of the mantle, I might have killed myself, then and there. Chapter 10. I knew enough about interstellar travel to realize that time frames and reference level fates were also adjusting. There would be no paradoxes, no curling or bunching up of world lines in slipspace. The secrets that lie between the streaking particles and waves that make up atoms are said to be vast. From those inner secrets, forerunners have prodded sufficient power to change the shape of worlds, move stars, and even to contemplate shifting the axes of entire galaxies. We have explored other realities, other spaces. Slip space, denial of locale, shun space, trick geodetics, natal void, the photon-only realm called the glow. But the vastness between suns is great, and mysterious in a very different way. Our familiarity with these distances has, I think, almost been lost, because we cross them so blithely. But no forerunner memory would be great enough, perhaps not even the combined memories of all the forerunners who ever lived, to remember the second-by-second events of a simple walk between two neighboring stars, this far out in the galactic arm. We fly over and above, but just barely through all that. And yet, this journey, in this ship, seemed to me to last forever. I felt it in my unarmored flesh and bones. I was naked to space for the first time in my life. I hated it. We arrived. And then, perversely, I regretted that it was over. We looked down over a huge, bleak, rocky gray world, a slagged and singed corpse which must have recently supported life, for it still wrapped itself in an atmosphere sufficient to allow armored forerunners to survive, if not our humans. Shakus and Riser lingered in a corner of the command center. Riser tossed in restless half-sleep. Shakus looked out at us with a frightened, angry expression. He knew he was far from home. He suspected he would never return. He owed nothing to Forerunners, least of all to the Didact. I actually worried for him, strangely enough.
This used to be a precursor hub world, the Didact said. Once, it was covered with tremendous structures, mostly intact, extremely impressive.
I looked down, prepared to be awed. I had never heard of such a place. It made sense that the higher forms would conceal real treasure. The Didact's voice deepened.
It's changed, he said.
How changed? I asked. We walked around the command center, past the humans, the Didact leading the way as we surveyed hundreds of magnified images gathered from our first orbit.
No orbital arches. Looks as if they've collapsed out of orbit. Look at those long linear impacts. Everything's corroded. I recognize hardly anything. Not the arena, not the highway, not the giant's armory, nothing, really.
That can't happen, I said. Precursor artifacts are eternal. They are with us as reminders of our littleness forever.
Apparently not, the Didact said.
He seemed to be formulating a theory. Then he clapped his hands, massive, booming slams of armor and flesh, and pointed one arm up. The command center complied and began to search and magnify the sky across a broad spectrum.
You've studied the basic principles of precursor technology, what little we know? The Didact asked.
What little we think we know? No one has ever seen precursor technology in action.
I have, the Didact said.
And gave me a look from the corner of his dark, slitted eyes.
Once. Tell me what you know, what's changed in our understanding in the last 1,000 years, and I'll judge whether you might be of use to me.
The basic principle was called neural physics, I said. Precursors felt the mantle extended to the entire universe, energy and matter as well as living creatures, some say. The universe lives, but not as we do.
Some say. Since my exile, have we cracked their techniques, acquired their learning?
No. That is why I seek the Organon.
Well, it doesn't exist,
the Didact said.
Not as such.
Another layer of disappointment fell over my thoughts. I suppose I knew that, I said. But the quest is the joy of it.
Ever so. The quest, the fight, never the finding or the victory.
I looked up at the Didact, surprised. The Voyager sensors scanned heat and other radiation signatures in the sky, latencies in cosmic ray patterns from the inner galaxy and outer reaches of the spiral arm.
Our humans should feel right at home here, he said. Once, they knew these worlds better than Forerunners. They fought and died here, surrounded by precursor ruins.
He slowly turned, the displays silently precessing with him. Then he pointed out a void in the system's magnetic flux.
There was recently a huge construct nearby, no more than 300 million kilometers from here.
Precursor? I asked.
No, Forerunner, but big enough. The size and mass were sufficient to create a persistent distortion in the system's field. See that? It even leaves a mark in the stellar winds.
How recently?
Judging by the diffusion of its magnetic shadow, 4 or 5 decades ago. Portal technology has grown enormously more powerful. But to move such an object, they must be slowing other traffic throughout the galaxy.
He swept out his hands like a sculptor and tugged down virtual charts, diagrams, simulations based on the sensor's measurements. What they revealed was a circular gap in the interstellar medium and a drawn-out loop in the star's vast, slowly wobbling magnetic field, its patterns smearing outward for hundreds of millions of kilometers.
This world was recently used as a test subject,
the didact said.
I can guess by whom.
Test for what?
They transported a great, sinful weapon into the system and fired it. Then they left and took it with them. The builders are going ahead with their plan. Complete neural destruction. When I entered my exile, the designs had not been finalized. Apparently that's changed. This time, they tried it on a limited scale. However, there has been an unfortunate side effect, one I hope they did not anticipate. We must act quickly.
The displays quivered and vanished.
The librarian heard about the test. Knowing she would try to alert me, the builder set up surveillance to watch her. She could not come to release me herself, but she had made other arrangements by using what she loves most. Our most problematic brethren.
He glanced at the humans.
Ultimately, they helped save me from being captured. They are her servants, whether they know it or not.
They know, I said.
And whether I like it or not, she knew they must become my allies.
The didact said.
You as well. We're going down to the planet, all of us. You'll require armor. The ship will outfit you.
Chapter 11. The armor took an hour to grow up around me, with numerous half-visible engineering units, small and large, flitting from the bulkheads to adjust and connect the necessary parts, then to activate, and then cut me and my fresh armor loose. At first, the humans refused, but after being chased around the command cabin by rippling bands, they were finally cornered and forced to submit. Shakas seemed more willing than Riser, even curious. But the poor Florian was mortified, growling to himself and trembling. The didact tried to reassure him with a finger stroke across his cheek. Riser bit him. The didact withdrew, then waited, impatiently. As there was nothing else to do except wince at some minor pinching, I observed my Promethean kidnapper with what I hoped was more discernment and sophistication, based on the experience I had gained in the last few pentads. I had never met anyone like the didact. Warrior servants, as a rule, kept to themselves, except to respond to commands from political leaders, most often builders. A few warriors, among them Prometheans, had once served on various councils, but only in an advisory capacity. Skill at war, however necessary at times, has always seemed shamefully contradictory to the basic principles of the mantle. Still, Forerunners had used warriors many times, and likely would again. Hypocrisy is its own collapsing mineshaft, my swap father was fond of saying. The didact walked around me, punching my shoulder and torso ribbons, poking a darkly shielded finger into the interstitial at my neck, and generally putting my armor through a series of forceful tests, none of which I felt was strictly necessary. My armor, smoothly curved and silvery gray, helmet edges sweeping back from my facial features with trim lines of white and green, was already sufficiently functional to provide me with lists of command structures such as would be made available to manipulars. But here, on this ship, access seemed to be expanded, as if I were tapping into the didact's own stores. And then, I heard a familiar voice. The little blue feminine shape reappeared in the back of my head. I felt subtle tendrils establish the necessary connections with memory and thought. My Ancilla. I am here, Manipular, she said. I cannot establish a connection with your previous Ancilla. Until that connection is made, may I serve you to the best of my ability?
You're from the librarian staff, I said.
That seems to be the case.
An Ancilla like you got me into this situation. Are you here to serve me or the librarian?
Are you disappointed by your present circumstances?
That took me aback. I looked across the command center. The humans were clumsily adjusting to their outfits. Riser was much taller than he was used to, walking stiffly on long legs that put him on a level with Shakus. The didact was deep in study of the system's trace in the photonic realm of the glow, which might reveal even more evidence of what had happened here. I'm in way over my head, I said to my Ancilla. I don't like being twisted around and held against my will, even to compensate for my foolishness.
Do you feel foolish?
The voice asked.
Shakus approached.
I also have a woman in my clothes, he said with a wry twist of his mouth. She says she will help me. She's blue.
Where is she, really?
She doesn't exist except in your armor and your head, and wherever she gets her information from, perhaps the ship.
Can I sleep with her? Marry her? Shakus asked.
I'd like to see you try.
Shakus was not much enlightened by this answer.
What kind of help do I need? He asked.
Riser walked about with increasing confidence and joined us, eyes darting as if he were being shown things only he could see.
Doesn't itch. Pretty in here, but I can't see my family, only her. She looks like Hamanush, but she is not part of my family.
I found it interesting that the Ancilla would adopt Riser's physical form. Shakus turned to me.
Hamanush live with ancestors in their heads. Shamanush do not.
She will answer your questions, I said, both of you, if you figure out what to ask.
Riser nodded.
Perhaps she is somebody's ancestor.
And he closed his eyes. The didact broke from his study and approached us.
They look silly,
he said of the humans.
You look... What's wrong?
My Ancilla was programmed by the librarian.
So is mine,
the didact said.
We're here at her request to fulfill a mission we set for ourselves 1,000 years ago. It's not starting at all well.
I don't feel free to ask what I need to ask or study what I need to study, I said.
You are certainly not free, if by that you mean free to act like a selfish manipular.
You mean suck it up, I said.
Exactly.
He drew down more displays.
From orbit, I can't make the necessary inspection. We're going down to the surface, all of us.
The humans are just animals. They're not ready for this, I said.
I fought those animals once,
the didact said.
Believe me, they're capable of surprising you. Make sure they're prepared. This will not be an easy landing.
Shakus put on a statue-like expression of calm disdain as I passed along this information.
There's a barren planet below, I said. We're going to land.
What's he want with us?
Shakus asked.
I'd sell him for a bag of fruit, Riser said.
I was dismayed by how much sympathy I felt for these two inferiors. Animals, perhaps, but not fools. What then was my excuse?
Atmosphere sang against the hull. The ship shuddered at the new strains on its fresh construction. It hadn't yet integrated, hadn't tested itself under all conditions, especially planetfall.
The librarian protects you, I told them, but the librarian looks after him, too. Something big happened here, something other forerunners have kept secret. I returned to the didact. He was lost in research, his armor connecting with the ship to take on new volumes of knowledge.
Somewhat to my surprise, my ancilla synced with his, and I accessed an intricately stepped and footnoted chart of relationships concerning the didact himself. He wanted me to know more about him. 10,000 years ago, the librarian and the didact had first met on Charum Hakor, the political center of the human Sanshum Empire. The final battle of Charum Hakor had broken the human Sanshum alliance and destroyed the last reserves of human resistance. That battle had been notorious, a great victory. But from the point of view of Mantle Orthodoxy, of course, supremely disgraceful. Victory did not bring joy for the didact. The limb of the barren gray planet expanded. Our ship took on an aerodynamic configuration, bowing out at the sides, altering its propulsion, growing huge landing pads and radiating fluxor shields against blowback. We were about to land on a dead world in a dead system. The horizon was rugged in the extreme. Below, "This is Charum Hakor, isn't it?" I asked. The didact did not answer, but I sensed the truth.
"The fools,"
he murmured. He looked at me with a deep sadness. The contrast between his face and mine, the depth of experience, sorrow, character.
"And they claim that warriors violate the mantle."
Slowly, we descended through the last few kilometers of atmosphere. Our armor locked itself to the deck. Behind me, Riser chirruped bitterly about being unable to move. The command center shifted its bulkheads and opened a direct viewport to the surface. We were landing in darkness.
"Humans made Charum Hakor the center of their empire to be close to one of the greatest collections of precursor structures,"
the didact said.
"They believed they were the true inheritors of the mantle."
"Heresy, right?" I asked.
"It was one cause of our war,"
the didact said.
"Not the primary cause, however. Humans resented Forerunner expansion outward. For 50 years, scattered through the galactic arm, humans probed our settlements and positions. Then they allied with the Sanshum, combined their knowledge and created weapons against which my warriors had little defense."
"Settlements? I thought Forerunners didn't need new planets, that we'd achieved maximum growth." The didact sighed.
"There are many things builders do not teach to their young,"
he said.
"Earlier displacements around Orion and in toward Galactic Center forced us to move native populations from their home regions to new, outer systems. The librarian and her staff cataloged and searched for the most appropriate matches, those stars most like native suns."
"You shuffled planets?"
"Yes,"
the didact said.
"Humans are naturally purists. They resent having to live with other species. In fact, they're among the most contentious, bigoted, self-centered..."
He looked back at Riser and Shakus.
"I never understood how my wife tolerated them."
"Forerunners don't like living with other species either," I observed.
"Yes, but for good reason,"
the didact said.
"We enforce the mantle. We must focus and protect and preserve all life, including ourselves."
I had been taught this principle often enough, yet now it rang incredibly hollow. "The humans wanted to be left alone," I said.
"Oh, they were expanding as well, and happily displaced and destroyed on their own. The Sanshum are not naturally inclined to war. They are a handsome, intelligent race, besotted with eternal sexuality and youth. They hope to spend their lives in luxury. For all that, their science was extraordinary. I suspect that given a few more centuries, humans and Sanshum would have fallen out with each other. Humans would undoubtedly have devastated their more effete allies. We saved them that trouble."
"You devastated both,"
I said.
We made a pact with the Sanshum. For the humans, there was no pact. The librarian managed to save some. More than I suspected.
Pardon the insolence? But your relationship with the Life Shaper does not seem ideal.
You don't know the half of it. Brace yourself, Manipular. This ship is still young.
There were several more groaning shudders, and then a great shivering bounce, which must have been impressive outside our cabin buffers. The ship settled, and all sense of motion ceased. The horizon outside appeared grayer and more rugged. Strange, spiky mountains rose everywhere. But closer scrutiny revealed these could hardly be natural formations. The outlines were slumped, rounded, decayed, but still monumentally artificial. Once, these ruins had formed the anchors and foundations for the superstructures of an ancient precursor world. Their system-linking, unbending filaments. But something had reduced those supposedly irreducible foundations and the filaments themselves to slag. The very thought chilled me. Precursors built for eternity. Atmosphere is not optimal, my armor reported as we descended the egress tube. What the ship sensed and measured, we all knew instantly. Reiser and Shakus were not happy. Reiser tried to climb back up the wall of the tube, but it rebuffed him.
You should have seen this world in its prime,
the didact said.
It was magnificent. A center of mysterious, dormant power that humans could live among, look at, but never begin to comprehend. Now, look at what we've done.
Anger and dismay mixed in his tone. How? I asked. How do you destroy precursor artifacts? They're inviolate, eternal.
They understood the universe in ways we never will. We can't unlock their secrets. But now, apparently, we can destroy all they ever made. That's what I call progress.
Chapter 12. The ship had come down near the perimeter of an arena many kilometers wide. The irregular walls of the arena consisted of huge chunks of rubble, tens of meters in size, broken along crystal plains. The plains glinted in the low light of a blue-white sun, a blinding point near the horizon. The atmosphere on the surface was cold, thin, poor in oxygen. The sky above thick with clouds of stars in one direction, almost empty in the other. Out there, beyond the diffuse edge of the galaxy, was the emptiness of intergalactic space.